Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, January 7th, 2007, first show of the new year here on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, on again a bizarro winter's day in our environmentally interesting era. We have today a wonderful guest, a longtime journalist and now one of the leading media critics of our times, Judy Daubenmeyer, joining us today to discuss her new book, Project Rewire, her work at newshounds.us, and her general take on the state of journalism today and the positive and negative signs around us. So join us today for Media Matters, but first let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
On December 29th, without the benefit of holding an open meeting, the Federal Communications Commission formally gave its blessing to a merger of AT&T with Bell South. The $85 billion deal creates the largest landline, wireless, and broadband company in the country by far, with tentacles in at least 22 states. The FCC vote was 4-0, with Commissioner Robert McDowell abstaining to avoid ethics concerns stemming from his prior work as a lobbyist for other phone companies. After several months of wrangling, on December 28th, AT&T submitted a list of merger conditions to the FCC for its consideration. Key to passage of the deal was a company commitment to preserve the principle of network neutrality on how it treats the traffic that crosses its broadband network. However, the promise is only good for 2 years. Another important concession will allow customers of AT&T the choice to buy their phone and broadband internet connections separately, something AT&T would sell in a package only before. However, it's not clear that AT&T's network will be able to separate DSL signals from dial tones that easily, and that separation clause is only good for 30 months, after which AT&T could force consumers to buy many more services than they actually need to get what they want. But these conditions are only temporary. They preserve the status quo in telecom policy, not make it much better. That will be the job of Congress in the new year, to pass legislation that makes network neutrality the law of the land, setting the principle of internet freedom in stone. It will be an uphill battle. AT&T's lobbying largesse surpasses that of the entire cable and satellite TV industries combined and dwarfs any other media company. We'll have much more on this story and its implications during our special on-location coverage from the National Conference for Media Reform in Memphis, Tennessee, coming up next weekend.
The announcement that Clear Channel is being bought up by two private investment firms for nearly $19 billion opens a new can of worms in the debate over media ownership. Unlike public media conglomerates, whose holdings are clearly known, private investment firms dabble in a wide range of industries, and many of them may already be large stockholders in other media firms. While there's no definitive evidence that the investors buying Clear Channel have other strategic media holdings, the situation might arise where one investment firm could have its fingers in so many media pies that it might run afoul of FCC and other limits on how much media a single company can control. It's a trend worth watching in the future as more media mergers and acquisitions are announced in 2007.
There can be no question about it. Consolidation in the radio industry has most definitely limited diversity on the dial. So says a recent report from the Future of Music Coalition, which used industry-collected data to evaluate the number of program formats available in markets across the country. Some of the findings? The number of radio station owners peaked in 1995 and has declined precipitously since then, thanks to the massive consolidation allowed by the passage of the Telecommunications Act of 1996. In fact, the number of stations owned by the 10 largest companies in the industry increased 15-fold between 1985 and 2005, the last year for which data was available. Radio industry revenue has consolidated as well. In 1993, the top four radio companies made 12% of the money in the business. Now they capture half of it. The same is true with listenership. Today, more than half the U.S. population tunes into stations owned by just two companies, Clear Channel and CBS Radio. On the programming front, just 15 formats account for 76% of the commercial radio programming available in America today, and many of those formats overlap greatly. Most of the largest broadcasters focus on just 8 primary formats, and specialty programming, including public affairs shows, are predominantly provided by independent stations or smaller radio companies. The Future of Music Coalition recommends the FCC consider lowering the number of stations a single company can own, both locally and nationwide, in order to reverse the industry's decade-long trend of homogenization. It also suggests that more station license opportunities be awarded to independent groups, both for full-power and low-power radio stations, and that the practice of payola, which is already technically illegal but nonetheless is widespread within the radio industry, be fully investigated and prosecuted by the FCC to the fullest extent of the law. You can read the full report on radio consolidation online at www.futureofmusic.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
I'm coming to you from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, of course, in WILL AM 580. This first Sunday of 2007, I hope we'll have 52 great shows for you this year, and I think we're going to lead off with a bang today. Our guest today is a longtime journalist turned author and instructor and media critic, Judy Dobenmeyer, author and editor of the new book Project Rewire, blogger, and one of the key people involved in doing research at the NewsHounds website, newshounds.us, and also a longtime 25-year reporter for Associated Press. Our pleasure to welcome Judy Dobenmeyer to Media Matters today. Judy, are you there?
Yes, I am. I'm glad to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, it's a privilege to have you on the air. I very much enjoyed reading your book over the last few days. It's been my sort of treat to myself.
It's great.
And it's an interesting book because it is about half or so is your book, really, your argument, your essay. And then the last section of the book is a series of shorter pieces by a number of very prominent writers, Jay Rosen, John Nichols, Greg Palast, Robert Perry, Josh Marshall, David Sirota, Danny Schechter, I mean, people who've been on our show, Josh Silver. So what was the thinking behind the structure of the book to make it that way?
Well, this book is really part of a series by William James and Company called the Informed Citizen series. And Tom Sumner, the editor there, had this concept that, you know, when you read the Internet, read articles on the web, you start off on one topic and you click on a link, and then you go to another article and you click on a link there, and pretty soon you're far afield from the main topic that you set out to read about. So he asked what would happen if you could freeze the Internet and look at all the articles on a certain topic without, you know, getting distracted. And so he came up with this concept, and this is the third book in the series, where someone writes a sort of an essay that sets the tone, sets the context, the parameters of the issue, and then goes out onto the web and selects articles that illustrate aspects that are discussed in the context-setting essay. And the others were on Donald Rumsfeld and the war in Iraq. This one was on the media, which was really my favorite topic. And what I've done is write an essay about the importance of journalism to our participatory democracy, really since before the founding of our country in colonial days, and sort of talking about what especially has happened in the last 40 to 50 years to change journalism. And then I went out and found articles from the very great writers that you mentioned, Jay Rosen, Bob Summerby, Josh Marshall, and so forth, and then even some lesser-known people, sort of the informed citizen-type people who are writing on the web as media critics. And then we packaged them all together to create this sort of history and then current criticism that's coming from the Internet.
Now, Judy, part of your background, of course, is writing, being a professional journalist in the mainstream media for a quarter century, if I understand correctly.
Yes.
Was that entirely with AP, or did you work for a newspaper at some point?
I worked for two newspapers. I worked for the Waterloo Courier in Waterloo, Iowa, and the Cedar Rapids Gazette in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, which is still, I'm very proud to say, privately owned. It's not corporate owned. It's still owned by a family. And so about half my career was with newspapers and half was with the Associated Press. Most of the time, I was covering government, state government, and that, I think, really informs my view of the importance of journalism and participatory democracy. My career sort of spans the time that I write about in the book. Begins post-Watergate, my career did, and really at a high point in journalism, I think, up through the 1990s when I saw journalism sort of losing its higher calling and becoming obsessed with celebrity news and trivial news and sort of losing its edge, losing its purpose, really, for supporting democracy.
Judy Dobenmeyer, you said that you covered state government, and I think this is an issue we periodically talk about on Media Matters. It doesn't get much attention, which is the importance of media for covering state and local government. And how, from your experience, starting with the dailies in Iowa, going through Associated Press, covering that beat from the early 70s until the late 90s, how would you say the treatment of state and local politics changed over that period in the U.S. news media from your experiences?
It became subject to the same sort of trends that we saw at the national level, much more trivial. You know, when I first started out, we covered, and the Gazette still does, devote a lot of space to the daily goings-on of the state legislature. By the 1990s, when I had begun working for the Associated Press in Michigan, the coverage was minimal. And still, big newspapers like the Detroit Free Press, they have a bureau in Lansing, Michigan, covering state government, but hardly anything gets into the newspaper on a daily basis. And I really have trouble telling from reading the Free Press on a daily basis whether that whether the legislature is in session, because there's no daily coverage. Every once in a while, there's a story, and I wonder how they justify having that bureau there on a daily basis. In my own career, I was covering the government, state government in Lansing, Michigan, at the time when the state legislature was revamping funding of education. This was a big story. This was something that had been attempted for 20 years, and finally there was going to be a rewrite of education funding laws that would take Michigan away from reliance on the property tax and shift it to the sales tax, a 50% increase in sales tax from 4 cents on the dollar to 6 cents on the dollar, and rewriting how that money was distributed to give more to poor schools, property poor districts, and it was going to affect everybody in the state, whether you had a child in public schools or not, because public schools are so important to the training of our workforce and the training of our citizens. And in the middle of that debate, one of the Detroit papers, and I don't remember which one anymore, wrote an article about the legislators squabbling amongst themselves over where they should park. And we got a directive from our superiors saying we should focus on that type of story. And literally they told us, find out where they park. You know, I'll never forget that phrase. It just appalled me that that was what we were supposed to be focusing on, that type of story at a time when so much else was happening. But they were getting pressure from newspapers who thought, hey, we want cute stories, we want bright stories, we want funny stories. We don't want all this dry, heavy, you know, issue-oriented stuff, you know, find out where they park. And that sort of just sums it up. That's what was happening, I think, in a lot of places around journalism.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Judy Dobenmeyer, the author and editor of the brand-new book Project Rewire, New Media from the Inside Out, just published by William James and Company. Judy Dobenmeyer spent 25 years as a professional journalist, working in daily journalism and at Associated Press, and has worked in recent years as a blogger. We'll talk about that at the website newshounds.us, and doing research on the state of the media and becoming one of the leading media critics in the United States today. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Judy Dobenmeyer, telephone number here at Media Matters is 333 1-800-222-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And Judy, I do want to dive into the book and into the current events, but I just before we go there, I'd like to wrap up the discussion of your own career and your own experiences, because it really gives your argument, I think, a great deal of credibility that sometimes isn't always attached to the criticism that other people make, including myself.
Okay.
Which is, how did your peers... I mean, you clearly wrestled with these issues and sort of got out of the field and said, I've got to approach this in a different manner. How did your peers, while you were in the newsroom, while you were at AP, respond to the same pressures? And what is your sense of how working journalists still in the newsrooms, still at the AP bureaus, are responding to the pressures today?
Well, you know, we had to respond to our bosses, you know, so we tried to accommodate as well as we could. We tried to find light stories, and we also tried to find stories that explained how legislation affected people. Now, that was an important trend, and it was one that we needed to participate in. You know, what does legislation that's being passed mean for Joe Sixpack, as we used to say? And we really tried to do that, but that is hard to do on a deadline. So we felt more pressure to do that, which was an important thing to do. But also, there was just sort of a feeling of being kind of beaten down at some point for some people. And I think a lot of people who were my age generally tended to leave the profession. Younger people went on to, some people went into careers in public relations. So, you know, there was a tendency to leave the profession that I think is pretty common. But you tried to cope as best you could. One thing I want to emphasize is I don't want to come across as like a Bernie Goldberg, you know, the guy who quit CBS and ever since has been making a ton of money talking about how terrible the news media is and what a bunch of liberals it is. You know, I really still see the value of newspapers. I want to support newspapers and the news business and the news media, and I want to help it get better. I'm not here to tear it down and to criticize it and to just throw stones at my former employer. That's not what I'm about at all. I want the news business to survive and thrive and be strong.
Our guest is Judy Daubenmeyer today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. She's the author of the new book, Project Rewire, New Media from the Inside Out. And about a little over half the book is your work. And it's really, I'd say, oh, maybe not. I don't know the exact percentage, but about half. And it is really a terrific essay on sort of the state of news today and how we got here over the past half century. I really enjoyed reading it. And one of the themes you talk about, in addition to sort of the commercial pressures that owners put on newsrooms to do journalism that's conducive to the bottom line, is also the increase in explicit partisan pressure on newsrooms. And this especially comes out, of course, in television news at the national level. Talk a little bit about how you saw that take place and then, you know, what your response has been.
I talk a little bit in the book about the founding of a group called Accuracy in Media. And, you know, this, I'm really relying on the work of other people here, of course. This is not my own research here, but Richard Mellenscaife in the late 1960s, reacting to the power of the press as exemplified in the Watergate scandal, funded a group called Accuracy in Media that set out to claim consistently over and over that the media was biased towards in favor of liberals, the myth of the liberal media, and to pressure the media to really give more voice to conservative viewpoints and to sort of cow the news media away from expanding the dialogue to include liberal voices. And I didn't really notice that pressure too much, really, until the 90s. And I think that part of the reason was about that same time, the late 80s, we also lost the Fairness Doctrine. And that, you know, required broadcast media to present both sides, to give equal time, in many cases, to conservative and liberal viewpoints. Well, once that was gone, there was a dominance of talk radio that was conservative by, you know, a margin of more than 10 to 1 in terms of hours of conservative talk radio versus progressive or liberal talk radio. And those people, the Rush Limbaughs of the world, the Sean Hannitys of the world, they added to this drumbeat of liberal, the myth of the liberal media. And that is when we really started feeling the pressure in the early 90s of people, the general public, telling us, oh, you know, you're biased, or getting phone calls. And you really had to be on your toes to make sure that you gave nobody any reason to criticize you. And that makes reporters more cautious.
Did you think, just to interject on that point, do you think it had the effect also, if not perhaps subconsciously, if you're a reporter, you know that if you go after a liberal Democrat, maybe miss it and go a little too hard at the liberal, you're probably not going to take a lot of heat because no one's going to call you. Right. But if you go after that conservative Republican with this exact same caliber of coverage, you're going to have your phone line burning up and you're going to have someone yelling at you, and you're maybe in the back of your mind saying, well, you know, do I really want that?
Exactly. It causes people to pull their punches, to exercise some self-censorship in the types of stories they go after, and to treat one side with kid gloves and the other side, not so. And there was no countervailing pressure from the other side. You know, if the liberals would have been complaining that, oh, you know, you're biased towards us, you know, it kind of would have helped keep things in the middle. But there was only pressure coming from the one side. And that is where our coverage began to be skewed, and you can see it in terms of who's the guests on shows, television shows, talk shows, overwhelmingly conservative, even in the 90s when we had a Democratic president and you'd have thought there'd have been more balance. But and it's regardless of the media, it isn't just Fox News. It's the mainstream media, CBS as well. If you look at the numbers that various people have gathered regarding talk show, who was on television shows in prior to the Iraq War, the pro-war voices on CBS weren't that different from in numbers and compared to the pro-war voices on Fox News. So, yeah, it does have an impact. It causes reporters to take the safe route, to be more critical of one side and kind of leave the other side alone because they don't want to get the phone calls, and they don't want their bosses to get the phone calls either.
You were one of our guests that we've had on the show several times has been Robert Greenwald. In fact, we have Robert on just about every time he has one of his new films out, and he's getting more prolific than the Beatles in their prime. That's usually about every 6 months.
Right.
One of the films that I think drew a lot of attention to Greenwald's work was Outfoxed, Rupert Murdoch's War on Journalism. You served as one of the researchers, one of the core researchers for that documentary. What did you learn doing the research for that? I mean, what were the lessons of getting in there and really going through, you know, countless hours of Fox News broadcasts that you learned that you didn't know before you started that project?
There was a lot I didn't know. When I left journalism, I had gone back to college, to graduate school. I got a PhD in American history. I wasn't involved in politics in any way till the Iraq War 6 years later. And so I joined Move On and was active, got involved, found out about their media corps, and started doing media monitoring of Fox News for them when Robert Greenwald approached Move On and asked for volunteers to help out with Outfoxed. So I started really watching it in a sustained fashion. And I thought that I was going to have to be looking for things like Walter Cronkite raising his eyebrow in a certain fashion, the way he was criticized, you know, back in the 60s for his coverage of the Vietnam War. You know, I thought that's the type of thing I was going to see. But I was amazed. I didn't really know that Fox News was such a propaganda arm for the Republican Party. I thought it was just another one of those cable channels with a lot of shout-out shows on them. So it was an eye-opener for me, who had been in journalism. Of course, Fox was brand new when I was leaving the field, so I didn't, you know, tune into it that much. And I was amazed at the way the bias permeates the news. The defense that Rupert Murdoch has given time and again for the partisanship of Fox News is that, oh, it's only in our opinion shows like O'Reilly Factor or Hannity and Combs. But what is appalling is the way it permeates what they call their fair and balanced news programs. And that was a real shock to me. And I continue, as part of the www.newshounds.us blog, to try to point out in the news programs their bias and their really appalling flaunting of journalistic standards on a daily basis that is just really totally in conflict with their claim to be fair and balanced.
Our guest, Judy Dobenmeyer, author of the new book, Project Rewire, one of the lead researchers at NewsHounds.us, a longtime journalist. If you have questions or comments for Judy Dobenmeyer, the number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. You are listening to WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Judy Dobenmeyer, on the on Fox News, you know, one of the questions that's sort of interesting is, people have speculated, you know, how committed is Rupert Murdoch to right-wing politics? Because after all, in Britain, he got in bed with Tony Blair once he saw the handwriting on the wall that the Labour Party was coming into power. And he's already thrown a fundraiser for Hillary Clinton in the United States. At the same time, he threw one for John McCain. You know, with the Democrats winning Congress and with the prospects of maybe the Democrats coming into having a sweep in 08, should we expect that Fox News will opportunistically now change pace, or is this purely an ideological right-wing station in your view?
Well, I think that if a Democrat took the presidency and Democrats maintained control of Congress, there might be a possibility that Rupert Murdoch might try to get in bed with them as he did with Tony Blair, as you mentioned. But I don't see that right now. What I see right now is continuing to attack Democrats. And I'll give you just one example.
Sure.
Just last week, Nancy Pelosi, first woman to be sworn in as Speaker, Fox News is covering her that day on their morning show, Fox and Friends. This is a news broadcast. They describe it as fair and balanced. Steve Doocy, the co-host, does when they go to breaks. They say, Fox News, fair and balanced, right here on Fox and Friends. And they begin their coverage with describing an old dispute between Pelosi and Jane Harman over the Intelligence Committee chairman. They bill it as a cat fight, sort of demeaning it, ridiculing it as, you know, a couple women squabbling. And then they go to the story about apparently Pelosi saying at a tea that she's the most powerful woman in America. And so they mock her, the anchor does. This is a news program, saying, all rise, Nancy Pelosi has taken control. In the meantime, in the background, they're playing Pomp and Circumstance, the music from Pomp and Circumstance. And then when he mentions her name a few minutes later, the same music plays again, and he smirks. Now, this is a news program. This is not Bill O'Reilly. This is not Hannity and Combs. This is the news program, and he's ridiculing and satirizing and belittling a newsmaker in the context of a news program. Now, that type of thing doesn't get a lot of attention in the general public. And when we write about it on the blog, some people say, oh, you're nitpicking. No, we're not. That's a breach of journalistic conventions to do that within the content of a news show. And that happens day in and day out. So I don't see any evidence that they're giving up, that they're moving closer to the Democrats. And I think the reason is, you know, Rupert Murdoch is all about making money. That's what he's all about, making tons of money. And he's figured out that he can make plenty of money from the 25% of the American public who still thinks Fox News has a lot of credibility. And until he finds out that there's another market that's going to make him more money, I don't think he's going to change.
Now, the audience for Fox News, and I might not have this right, I suspect you'll know the answer to this. My sense from what I've read is that it has not really been growing dramatically in the last couple of years. Is that right?
Oh, it has been falling. Double digit, something like 24% fall off in viewership from a year ago. Now, some of that, you know, Katrina really pumped up the cable numbers a year or so ago,
mm-hmm.
and some of that is a fallout from that. But the other cable networks are not seeing those sorts of declines, and some of them, like CNBC, has even seen increases. and some other shows have seen increases. So Fox has topped out. Either their format is stale and people are tired of it, or they have caught on to what is going on there, and it's not attracting new viewers or something. And another problem with their viewership is, if you look at a program like O'Reilly, the median age is over 70. And
wait, time out. The median age is over 70?
70. And so they are very low in what is called the money demographic, the 18 to 54 age bracket that is so coveted by advertisers. Their viewership there is, you know, maybe a fourth of their total viewership. So they're not attractive to advertisers.
So this would suggest, if your thesis is right, that Rupert Murdoch, you know, might be backing up the truck there to clear out the offices and get some hipper young people who are going to make more money for him down the road.
Well, you know, we may see Sean Hannity become more of a star on Fox News for that reason, because he's younger than Bill O'Reilly. And that may be behind the Dennis Miller, appearances on Fox News also. But that is a problem that they do have.
I mean, Dennis Miller might get you down into the 60s or even the late 50s, but I don't see that guy producing a lot of 20-year-olds.
No. He's probably their idea of somebody who's hip. Jon Stewart, that's for sure.
Yeah, our guest, Judy Dovenmeyer, author of Project Rewire. Also, one of the lead writers at the website, newshound.us, which monitors Fox News on a regular basis. And I think the subtitle for NewsHounds is "We Watch Fox So You Don't Have To."
That's right.
So you're giving us your intelligence report for those of our listeners here who haven't had a chance, don't have cable TV, or haven't been watching Fox recently. One of the real stories on TV news in the past, 6 months, I would say, has been Keith Olbermann sort of emerging as sort of a prominent liberal and progressive voice, proudly and defiantly, not in sort of the Combs milquetoast style where he sort of apologized for breathing next to Hannity, but just sort of defiantly taking a strong position. How have his ratings been doing?
He is doing very well. His are seeing, I don't have him right in front of me, but substantial increases, and he tells us about that every once in a while. I'm a regular Olbermann watcher.
You mean you're turning away from Fox News?
Well, I don't watch the Fox in the evening. I watch in the morning.
Okay.
I've
just
got morning
checking.
Shows. Okay. Yeah. Well, with the magic of TiVo, though, you can watch everything. But Olbermann just loves to crow when he keeps track of his numbers versus O'Reilly. And if he beats O'Reilly on a certain night, you hear about it. And he does, from time to time, he does actually beat O'Reilly, especially in that 18 to 54 demographic group. And they have sort of a running feud, as you know, O'Reilly and Olbermann, and, in fact, Fox News in general. And he's really making a living ridiculing them. But I think, his popularity is more than that. I mean, he has that hip feel, yet he has a lot of serious content in his show. So I think that he is he's a growing phenomenon on the web right now, on the television.
Sure. And you mentioned Judy Dovenmeyer, also Jon Stewart. And I think, of course, any discussion of TV news has to include Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert. Although they're comedians and they're comedy shows, they're invariably based around news themes all the time. And you commented favorably on Stewart a moment ago. Give me your take on them as a journalist. I mean, how do you respond to comedians doing news?
Well, I think what he does is really important. He does news criticism, what he does. And he has...
You're talking about Jon Stewart now.
Jon Stewart. He's got it down. You know, the reporters who have this sort of cynical, blasé attitude towards the news, the reporters who sort of take the side of newsmakers versus sort of the pesky public that's demanding more of them, and the way he can watch, every once in a while they do a take on Fox News, and they'll really pick out something like, for example, something called a new punctuation mark called the Cavuto. And what it was a series of examples of how Fox News, and especially Neil Cavuto, uses the question mark to ostensibly ask a question, but really to make a statement. It's sort of the "have you stopped beating your wife" approach.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a whole series of those. And it's something that the news hounds really can't do because we don't have the editing capacity to catch, to record 24 hours of Fox News on video and then review it. We can't really do that the way he does it, but it's brilliant. He really zeroes in on the essence of what's wrong with journalism as a whole and some of the little things that Fox News does. And as for Steve Colbert, he really has the pompous media blowhard pundit down. He's got him to a T, everything. And
now, do you think Colbert's shtick will wear off if this moment passes and he'll be sort of like Mr. T looking for another part?
Well, as long as those, as the foils remain popular, I think he's got a market. I mean, he's pretty good. In a lot of ways, I think he is better positioned than Jon Stewart is now with the change of power in Congress, because Jon Stewart may lose his edge when it comes time to criticize liberal Democrats the way he's been criticizing the Republicans when they control Congress. Of course, he still has George Bush to kick around, but Steve Colbert's shtick is not reliant on who's in power in Washington the way Stewart's can be influenced by that. So.
Okay, Dick. Our guest today on Media Matters, Judy Dobenmeyer, author of the new book Project Rewire, New Media from the Inside Out, a terrific short book from William James and Company, includes Judy's essay on the state of journalism today, how we got there, and then a lot of entries from people that our listeners are very familiar with, Jay Rosen, Greg Palast, John Nichols, who's one of our dear friends, David Sirota, Russ Baker, Bob Perry, Danny Schechter. Lots of people have been on the show, Josh Silver. I urge you to take a look at the book if you have an opportunity. Judy also works at the website newshounds.us, monitoring Fox News on a daily basis, watching, as she says, but watching Fox, so we don't have to. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment to Judy Dobenmeyer, the telephone number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I just like to say I enjoy the show today, and I listen to most of my radio news community and public radio stations, and I don't see so much liberal bias, but sometimes I do see forms of manipulation as far as how news is structured. One of the things I notice when I listen to public radio, they always start the newscast with the number of soldiers that are killed in Iraq every day, and then give a total count as well. Now, every year, 50,000 people die in car accidents. Nearly as many die from cigarette smoking. And I realize these are completely unrelated issues, but when you assess the value of a human life, are you saying the soldier's life is a more important news story than the person who dies in an automobile accident or dies from cancer or things of this nature? I would like to examine a news story on the merits of our public policy in that region, as opposed to the body count of our American soldiers. I don't like to be manipulated by the gut issue of loss of a human life, because I'm affected by the loss of human lives. But as far as the cost, I want to know, are those human lives being spent in a way where their lives matter and it's effective public policy?
Okay, Judy Dobenmeyer, do you have any, you talk about the coverage of the Iraq War a great deal in your book. What's your response to this?
Well, it'd be really hard for me to argue that there's been too much attention paid to the loss of human life in Iraq when we have never had an estimate from the federal government as to the total number of Iraqis who's been killed since we invaded that country. And since we've never hardly even seen any photos of caskets of dead soldiers returning to the United States because the administration won't allow us to even photograph those things, except there were some taken surreptitiously and published by one newspaper or so. So, by beginning with the body count, which is something the administration has tried to avoid, the body count, because it reminds them of the Vietnam War, what I think that the news channel or the public radio or whatever station you're listening to is doing is reminding us that there is a human cost to the war, and that we shouldn't lose sight of this. Now, there's a big difference between the people who die from cigarette smoking, which is basically something that they do, which it's an addiction, but they did start it of their own free will, and people who die carrying out the policy of this country in the name of all of us. That is a big difference, and that makes it more newsworthy to me than how many people died today of cigarette smoking, although there are certain times of the year when you might want to highlight that number. And certainly there, we give a lot of attention in this country to how many people are killed in car accidents. That is not something that is in any way ignored. Most newspapers run a weekend roundup, how many people were killed over the weekend, and they run it every Monday in their newspaper. So we get plenty of attention to people who are killed in car accidents. But calling attention to the cost, the human cost of the Iraq war is not something that the news media has really done a lot of. I just heard an article, a story is on Keith Olbermann the other night, estimating the cost of caring for veterans of this war will be between $350 billion and $700 billion throughout their lifetime. That is a big cost that's going to impact our children and their children in terms of having to pay for that. And nobody has been talking about that. So calling attention to the number of dead, certainly, and the number of injured has been way underestimated by the news media. Very little attention being paid to that, especially, well, you certainly never see it on Fox News, that's for sure. And people don't want to be reminded of it. They want to make these decisions based sort of in a vacuum. Yes, it would be good to support, it would be good to have our troops forever in the Middle East fighting terrorism if it didn't cost us billions of dollars and if people weren't dying for something that doesn't seem to be working. So, you know, you have to put a human face on things. Otherwise, people lose sight of what is really happening. You have to bring the war home to people.
You know, Judy, I don't think the caller was making this point, but I guess the test of whether this is a liberal bias against the Bush administration would be during Clinton's various wars in Kosovo, if in fact there was a different standard for covering it. There they didn't cover the human loss at all and kept it secret because they didn't want to embarrass President Clinton because they were biased toward him. And I don't know if there were enough casualties in those wars that you could even do any sort of comparison.
Well, I don't think there were any Americans.
Yeah, so that sort of makes it tough to...
I think the only soldiers who were killed under Clinton's watch were the ones in Somalia and the ones at the bombing of the coal. I don't remember a lot in between. So it's hard to make a comparison. Yes, it would be partisan bias. You're right. If they kept the number secret under Clinton and publicized it under Bush, they didn't do that. That didn't happen. You're right. I didn't.
Okay, well, let's go back to the phone lines. We have a bank of callers, and I promise we'll get to all of them. One caller did call in and she did not have it. She had to run to work and is listening on the radio, so she wanted me to ask on her behalf this question. In her view, Barney Frank is becoming sort of a media darling now. Is that what you're seeing, too? Does this make sense to you? And this caller comes from Crawfordsville, Indiana, one of our neighboring communities across the state line.
Well, it does. I mean, he's articulate. He even shows up on Fox. He's one of the few Democrats that they sort of respect, and I think it's because he won't take any guff from them. But I don't know that he is becoming any more popular than he was 3 or 4 years ago. So I'm not sure that he's a real media darling in the way Barack Obama is a media darling right now.
Our guest today, Judy Dobemeyer, author of Project Rewire, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580. We've got about 14 minutes left. We've got a couple of callers waiting very patiently, so let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 3, Urbana, you're on the air.
Is that me?
That is you, sir.
Okay, they told me it was line 1. Sorry about that.
Well, that's okay. Well, you're number 1 in our hearts.
Well, I had a suggestion for your blog.
Okay.
When you're watching Fox and you want to present something that's fair and balanced, that you might try mimicking them, actually mirroring their position, being as far off center on the other side as it would take to create a fair and balanced point of view if you averaged it with what they said, i.e., you take a snippet from what they said, yada, yada, blah, 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 and you say, to give you an example of how far this is from the truth, this is what somebody else on the other side would have to say, so far biased out that now you can tell how stupid this is.
Mm-hmm.
Just a suggestion. It makes people laugh. You could do it something like the Colbert Report or whatever. But if you do it accurately, it really surprises people by pointing out how far off center you have to be on one side to counterbalance how far off they are on the other side.
That's a great idea. Can I ask, are you a reader of New Sounds?
I just surf, you know.
Okay.
I don't read any site every day. I can't.
Yeah.
I'd be more than happy to email you or something if you'd like.
No, that's a great idea, and I'll pass it on to the other news hounds. We do occasionally do some satire. I mentioned the business shows, and they're not something that the general public and a lot of media critics really pay a lot of attention to, but they're really pretty eye-opening on Fox News.
Well, I don't really mean it as satire.
Yeah.
I'm more of mathematically oriented.
Yeah.
So when I said average, I really meant average.
Yeah, I get what you're saying.
Say if these guys are you know 5 degrees off of center or whatever measurement you have to take, say this is as close as we could come to what it would take to put these two sentences on a scale.
Yeah.
And have it come out pointing at the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be funny, but I don't think you'd have to do anything to make it funny.
Uh-huh.
I don't think you'd have to make it satirical.
Right.
You just have to say, if we were putting a fair and balanced mirror up to Fox, this is what you'd get mirroring them on the other side.
All right. Well, thank you very much, caller. That's a really interesting call. Let's go back to the phones. We have a couple very patient callers I've been holding up, and let's go right to them, right? Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with Judy Dobenmeyer.
I think that's me.
That's you.
Okay. This is from a piece I read in a newspaper at least 2 years ago, maybe longer ago, reporting on some academic studies of the impact of Fox viewership on what people believe to be true.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of them was from Maryland. I can't remember.
Yeah, this is actually a very famous set of studies.
And I didn't know, I didn't catch the first little bit of the show, and I didn't know if you'd mentioned that. The piece that I read, you can summarize the research if you want to in your response, but the piece I read raised the question as to whether this might be actually a measure of effectiveness from Rupert Murdoch's perspective, if people who view his news programs actually believe in a much higher proportion than the rest of the population that Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11.
Right.
And wouldn't that be what Rupert Murdoch would want to prove? So I didn't know if you'd mentioned those studies earlier.
No, Judy didn't. But Judy, do you have some thoughts on that?
Yes, I didn't mention them, but I might have referenced them in the book, and I'm familiar with them. And certainly it is in the Bush administration's favor, or in they would like to have people believe that, and so therefore Fox News is going to promote that idea. And in fact, you know, the study did show that Fox News viewers were much more likely than other Americans to believe that Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11, and even though there was absolutely no evidence of that, and promoting that agenda, promoting that belief is part of supporting George Bush, because that's one of the subtle ways that the war in Iraq can be justified is we're fighting terror. And the caller is absolutely right on that.
Judy, I know that David Brock's organization, Media Matters for America, which you mentioned here, which also monitors Fox but does the whole range of media. They don't just focus on Fox.
Right.
As well as Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And we've had Janine Jackson and Steve Rendell and Peter Hart and that crew on the air many times too. They look at Fox very closely. And both of them have had the privilege, therefore, of being mentioned in a very unfavorable manner on Fox itself on a number of occasions.
Yeah.
Have you won that distinction yet?
Yes, we have. Not personally, but Bill O'Reilly has held up a picture of our blog and said these people are off the charts left after we criticized him for something. Shepard Smith has mentioned us on Studio B. He said something happened on the show, and he said, oh, the news hounds are going to be all over us for that. So we know that they are aware of us. We know that they read us probably daily. They have supported a blog that is dedicated to watching us.
What's it called?
Johnny Dollar's Place. It's run by a guy named Johnny Dollar.
Mm-hmm.
I never go there, and neither does hardly anybody else, but we know it's out there. He comes on our blog and tries to disrupt the conversation, calls us liars and so forth. And we also know that there are what we call paid trolls, people who are paid to come to our blog. I don't know who pays them, but they have admitted in their postings, in their comment postings, that they're paid to be there. And they try to get the thread off topic and just try to discredit us in various ways. And I don't know if it's just some sort of, you know, conservative operation or whoever, but this happened a lot before the November election.
How do your journalist friends from the old days, or journalists you stay in touch with, you know, who you didn't work with, but just so you know, professional journalists, what do they think of the general critique you're making, and what do they think of the work you're doing at NewsHounds?
You know, I don't keep in touch that closely. I have one friend who works in Washington who I sent a link to the book about, and I haven't heard back. I don't know what that means, so she's busy. But and some of the other people, I have a friend in Iowa who I still keep in touch with, and he did comment in one of the interviews, in one of the newspaper interviews on the book, and he was very favorable about it. You know, I think the people who are still in the profession have had to make some compromises, and you know, I'm sure there's some sort of sour grapes thinking on their part. Well, you know, it's easy for her to criticize. She left, and mm-hmm. I'm still here dealing with it. I'm sure there's some of that feeling. So, now that I've written the book, I really want to go back and reestablish some of those contacts and just see what they have to say.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Judy Dobenmeyer. You've been listening to her speak just now. She's the author of Project Rewire, New Media from the Inside Out, a brand new book from William James and Company. She's a longtime journalist as well, and also works on the website newshounds.us and is a noted blogger. We have one more call waiting right now I want to get to. Line 4, Chicago, you're on the air with Judy Dobenmeyer.
Hi, I was wondering, how are we going to keep the media from, they're making themselves, they're vindicating themselves, even though they allowed the war to happen and everything, and they're going to come out and show some exposés now, and they're going to end up looking clean, and it's this media reform movement's going to lose steam because the public's going to think, you know, they're back to the Bible media again. And we've got to keep it alive, and they're going to schmooze this over us as, you know, here's the facts, and we're on the job now, you know. And how do we keep it from brainwashing the public that they're really on our side when they tell us things well after the timing is gone for making anything happen in Congress?
All right, well, thank you very much, caller. Judy, is the caller suggesting that coverage of the war has gotten less charitable to the administration's position and more critical, and I think probably by your standards, more accurate. Is that your sense from looking at news coverage of the war?
Somewhat. I mean, I think probably people are feeling that way because now the press is covering the Democrats in Congress, and there's a feeling that because the news has changed, maybe the media has changed too, and I'm not sure that that's true. But I think there is an important point that we need to keep up the momentum for media reform. And certainly the conference that's coming up in Memphis this week that you know all about.
Yeah, I think I might go there.
Yeah, National Conference for Media Reform is one way to do that. And there are new issues emerging all the time. You know, the fight over net neutrality, the pressure for low-cost wireless internet availability is there. And it's also a movement within journalism itself to continue reform. The Journalism That Matters Consortium, which is also having a conference in Memphis that kind of overlaps with the National Conference for Media Reform. And there's people within the media understand that they have to make themselves more relevant or they're going to disappear because of competition from the Internet. And that momentum is not going to go away just because in some ways their coverage of the war has improved. So there are, you know, lots of people thinking about how to reconnect journalists with the citizens and how to wean them away from this cozy relationship that they've really developed with newsmakers and with news sources, get them reconnected with the public through citizen journalism and so forth.
As you
so that momentum is building.
As you watch Judy Dobenmeyer, as you watch television today, TV news, and you watch the cable channels as much as anyone, it sounds like, as part of your work. And this also really applies to print news as well. What are the big stories that you think our press system, our mainstream press system, ought to be covering that are great news stories that simply aren't getting play, that aren't being covered, that we aren't hearing about or seeing?
Well, a lot of these are things that probably aren't very interesting to the average person, but are going to be really important. I think the loss and the instability of pension systems for people is going to be a real problem in the next 10 years that's going to surface as more and more companies, their pensions are becoming insolvent. The pension guarantee fund is not funded. I think that's going to be a big problem that we haven't heard about yet. I think it's not so much individual big stories as stories where the facts aren't checked. Fact-checking is something that the news and the media needs to do more of and using more context. I mentioned the cost of veterans, and I think that's something that we're going to have to be reading more about, the injuries and the returning veterans and the long-term cost of that has not gotten adequate coverage. And the loss of, jobs for unskilled people in this country, people that are 19, 20 years old, not college material. They used to be able to go to a packing plant or to some kind of manufacturing job and get a job. What is happening to those people today? How are they living? Covering that age group, that young age group that don't have the opportunities that people had 40 or 50 years ago to make a living wage and to support a family. I think I would zero in on that group because they're bearing the brunt of the economic changes that we're seeing in states like Michigan right now. And I think there's our stories to be told there.
We only have a few minutes left, Judy Dobenmeyer. Not even a few minutes, only a few seconds, actually. Real briefly, what media do you use? What do you consider the gold standard in your media diet of what you think is a must-read or must-view?
Well, I try to use a cafeteria approach. I read a daily paper, the Detroit Free Press, when I'm in Michigan, and half the year I'm in Arizona, so I read the Arizona Republic. Then I read the New York Times online. We do get a paper version. My husband reads that. I read the one online. Then I go to my blog, catch up there. Then I go to a certain blog called Juan Cole, Informed Comment, who's about Iraq and the Middle East. He's from the University of Michigan, where I also teach. I'm in program in American culture. I have a PhD in history.
You know what? I just got the signal from my producer that we're going to have to stop your media diet at that point, Judy Dobenmeyer.
All righty.
I want to thank Judy Dobenmeyer so much for being my guest today. She's the author of Project Rewire. My name's Bob McChesney. I'll be back a week today. Thanks to Colleen Cook for doing a great job producing the show. See you then. Bye-bye.